Continue looking at our study in the book of Revelation. I do want to say that I appreciate your patience with the introduction. This will be the last introductory sermon for the book of Revelation. The next week we'll jump into the text. But I wanted to cover one more thing as we get into the book of Revelation concerning symbols. And we've talked about looking at the symbols in relation to numbers and some of the other aspects with the Old Testament. There's also some symbolism when you look at the numbers in the book of Revelation, which we won't have time to cover, but I will mention that kind of as we go along. But tonight I want to talk about symbols based on historical background. Because when you look at the history that John is kind of interweaving within the context and within the text of the book of Revelation, it helps you really grasp how John is focusing on the past and those things that are happening and the things that will also happen in the future. But one of the main references that John talks about in the book of Revelation is the Empire of Rome. And because Rome was in power at that particular time, Rome was extremely important in relation to the persecution of Christianity. And the Roman Empire has been called the grandest political achievement ever accomplished. And who knows how long the Roman Empire might have stood if it had not decided to take on God as its opponent. And because of some of this, John is going to talk about the premise, really, when you think about the Roman Empire and how strong they were, but also how weak they were because of a lot of the immorality and their values and virtues that were happening at that time. But we have to keep all of this history and the historical aspect in mind when we look at the background of the book of Revelation and when we jump into it next week. So if you think ahead to some of the examples of historical symbolism, when you look at Revelation chapter 17 in verse 10, if you put that list of emperors alongside what John is talking about, it helps you grasp the concept of looking at the historical aspect of the book of Revelation. So one of the first things we have to ask ourselves was, why specifically was Rome persecuting Christianity as a whole? The original moral elements had fallen out of the state religion, and Rome did have a state religion. The official religion had really more or less become merely political and a military tool used to kind of promote the solidarity of the state of Rome at the time. And so it was really nothing in relation to that they were religious or that they were worshiping anything in particular, but just to say, based upon the model of society of the Roman Empire, we did have a quote-unquote religion. And many of the Romans embraced several different kinds of religion. Most of it had to do with idols or something along those lines. But non-Roman religions were categorized as either licensed or unlicensed. And so if you were licensed, you were allowed then to practice your religion within the confines of the Roman Empire. If you were unlicensed, either you were told to stop, or you could be persecuted, you could be put in jail, or even killed. And so nevertheless, the laws against unlicensed religions, for the most part, were kept or retained in the statutes or the laws or the books, even though most of the time the Romans felt, you know, we'll let them go and do whatever they want as long as they don't mess with the peace of the Roman culture, as long as they don't try to overthrow the government, and as long as they don't get in the way, and as long as they pay their taxes. And so when you look at the concept of Christianity, that's kind of the way that they looked as a whole concerning the Roman Empire. Christianity was an unlicensed religion, but it was received as licensed in its early history because it was considered an offshoot of Judaism. And because they had always had peace with the Jews as a whole, they said since this is such a small offshoot to begin with, it was never considered to be a political enemy. It was never considered to be anything which would overthrow the government at that time. So from the time of Nero, however, looking forward, of which John is going to kind of bring to the forefront as he's talking about the Roman Empire, Christianity begins to become suspect. Because at the rapid rate in which it was growing and beginning to spread, the Roman government and the Roman Empire began to pay attention to it. Hey, there's something to this. This all of a sudden came quickly on the scene. Judaism, we had known, had been around for several hundred years. All of a sudden, here's this idea of Christianity based upon one person of which the Roman government had a hand in killing. Said there's something to this because it's spreading so quickly. So the conflict between Rome and Christianity was inevitable for several reasons. The first was both were worldwide empires, if you think about it. Because Rome controlled so much militarily in relation to conquering the world, Christianity was conquering the world, and that was bringing so many adherents to it. And so many people were beginning to grasp the concept and follow what Christianity was about. Well, second, they appeared on the scene within just a few years of each other. Rome started out extremely small. Judaism in relation started out small, but when we see that and we look at prophecy from the Old Testament concerning Christ and the cross, how small Christianity is going to start out in relevance to Acts chapter 2, it begins to grow rapidly, right? The church is experiencing great growth and it's seeing joy throughout all of the different churches at that time. Third, how they kind of compare and why Rome considered this such a difficult thing was that Christianity, as well as being a Roman citizen, required allegiance to both. And so Rome said, if you're going to be a citizen of the Roman Empire, you have to basically give yourself to the Roman government. And if we ask you to do something, you're going to do it. If we ask you to give something up, you're going to have to do it. If we tax you more, you're going to do it because it's for the good of the Roman state. Well, if you think about that in Christianity, Christianity requires complete allegiance to the cause of Jesus Christ. Christ asks you to give something up when you come to the cross. Christ asks you to put away the old man when the new man is going to be born. So because Christianity requires complete allegiance to its soul core, because Roman requires complete allegiance to the state of the empire, both of these were going to begin to lock horns because of that. There could no be intertwining or one being a member of Rome at the same time worshiping Jesus Christ, because you would have to give up one or the other. Jesus said that He did not come to bring peace on earth, but a sword in Matthew chapter 10 and verse 34. Fourth, the truth of Christianity invariably conflicts with error. And so because you had Christians basically telling Roman citizens that you worshiping all these false gods is wrong. Because all of their false gods, based upon their state religion, Rome said, well, you can kind of do whatever you want and worship whatever you want. Christianity says there's only one true God that you can worship. And so again, you see this conflict. So we expect that Satan is going to use any means necessary to bring down what Christianity stood for. And what better thing to use than a great empire like Rome? And so all of the unlicensed religions, Christianity was probably singled out the most for punishment because of all of these concepts that it brought forth and what it was going to propose in relation to being something that was going to go against the state of Rome. So Christianity has a lot to say about the kingdom. So you can imagine, as Roman governors or Roman citizens are hearing these Christians talking about the idea of what the kingdom is. Well, to them, this is simply them going against the power of the Roman state. Hey, they're talking about this kingdom. Are they going to overthrow us? Are they thinking they're better than us? Is there another kingdom of which they're going to be a part of that's going to then knock down the Roman state? So to their mindset, they're thinking the Christians are becoming, to them, an enemy of the state. And so when you look at the views in which talk about death and punishment and judgment and all of these things, Christianity sounded completely revolutionary to them. You see, they're talking about a state of judgment of which they know they're going to have to stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And Christianity is saying everybody is going to have to stand before this judgment seat. And to the Roman Empire and to a Roman citizen who thought they were better than anybody else, you're not going to tell me that I'm going to stand before your God and be judged because I am a Roman citizen. And so again, this was also a threat to them. So with the sudden appearance of Christianity with so many followers, made the government a little bit nervous. And so what you begin to see is persecution of Christians. They were bringing them in by the droves, so to speak, and punishing them. Many times they were making them to denounce the name of Christ. You ever heard the term hot seat, being put in the hot seat? That comes from persecuting Christians, because what the Romans would do, and they were very good at persecution, is that they would take this type of metal or steel chair, something similar to this, and they would put a fire under it. And so they would make the Christians sit upon this, and a Roman soldier or two would stand back with a long pole or spear and put that up in them and make them sit in the seat until they would denounce the name of Jesus Christ, being put on the hot seat. And so their whole idea was, if we can make them denounce this so-called king, this so-called Messiah that they're willing to give their life for, then we then will have them in our cause, so to speak. And some Christians would do exactly that. Some would denounce the name of Christ. They didn't want to be persecuted. They didn't want to be killed. They didn't want any trouble from the Roman state. Yet you had individuals who were willing to die for the cause of Jesus Christ. Again, where you see John say in Revelation 2:10, to be faithful, even to the point if it means you have to die for the cause. That's what John is talking about there. And so because you had Christianity being persecuted at such a rapid rate, because they were trying to reduce the growth of Christianity as a whole, the Romans said, let's just persecute them. Maybe we'll kind of knock this cause out of their system. Maybe this is just a fad and we'll have it done away with. But now we know that wasn't going to be the case, right? But you see, because Christianity was so intolerant of other religions, because Christianity was claiming to be the only one true religion, the Roman government said, we're not going to have that. Because disciples were going around and telling people they had to convert and leave everything else behind, the Romans were not going to have that. So from the viewpoint of the government, Christians were stubborn and they were absolutely headstrong. The Romans just wanted the Christians to put a pinch of incense on their altars when they would offer up worship, because some were still practicing Old Testament theology. And so Christians were considered by some in the Roman government to be atheists because they said the gods of other faith, little g, were not gods at all. And so the Roman government looked at Christianity as atheism, so to speak. Because there's no way you can say that your God is the only God. So as time went by, Christians were starting to be accused of all the catastrophes that were coming about. If something bad happened to the government, if there was a bad storm or something horrible that would happen, Christians were going to be blamed for it. But the Christians pointed out that, hey, guess what? Disasters were here before Christianity was born. Pointing out that Christians were the most self-sacrificing and helpful people, and they rarely, in any sense, were going to be prejudiced towards even Romans, because we even see the account of Romans being converted. But one of the things that John also references in the book of Revelation is the state of Parthia. In Acts chapter 2, when the apostles are standing up and preaching that gospel sermon, converting souls to Christ, wrote about the nations that were present on the day of Pentecost. Well, Parthia was one of those governments, or one of those nations that were represented. Parthia was this small country. It was about 300 miles long, about 150 miles wide, and it was located just southwest of the Caspian Sea and is what is now known as northern Iran. And so by the time the book of Revelation was written, Parthia had taken over much of that specific region that was considered the old Persian Empire. Remember, Rome had such a large hand in overthrowing the Persian nation. And so now you have a lot of territory that was left untouched or unscathed because of the Roman conflicts, of which Parthia came in and began to claim. They said, we'll take this if you're not going to have any part of it. What Rome begins to see, they begin to see this as a threat to them. Parthia is beginning to move in. They're beginning to gain territory. We're going to have a major problem with this. But when you look through the book of Revelation, some of the imagery that John is going to use is based upon the nation of Parthia or the Parthians. For instance, if you look at Revelation chapter 6 and verse 2, and you have the rider with the bow and crown is reminiscent of the Persian or the Parthian coins, which depicted the horseman with a bow in his hand and a crown on his head. And so perhaps the most obvious allusions to Parthia are found in Revelation chapter 9 and in Revelation chapter 16. In chapter 9, it speaks of the great river Euphrates, where four angels were loosed to punish mankind. And the angels were identified as the armies of the horsemen, which would be a direct reference to the Parthian army. And so then you have in chapter 16, mentions again the great river, the Euphrates, along with the term kings from the east in Revelation 16 and verse 12. So the implication was that John is talking about here from a historical aspect is that God is going to use these nations and these kings to help overthrow the Roman government. And so what John is writing to a persecuted Christianity at this time was that you have to remain to have hope. Everything that God's doing has a purpose behind it. Everything that God's doing is for His greater good and for the greater good of the kingdom at large. And so what John is doing is he's trying to encourage them to hang on and don't give up. Remember, there's going to be a point where you might have to give your life for the cause of Christ, even to the point of death, he says in Revelation 2. But don't lose hope, because God is using all of these other entities outside of the Roman government that's persecuting Christianity at this time to overthrow the greater good of what the Roman government was trying to stand for. So when you think about one of the greatest incidents in Roman history was illustrated with Parthia and the Euphrates River, which signified the Roman Empire. And so along with Julius Caesar, Pompey the Great, and Crassus form what was called the Triumvirate. And so they got together because they thought as three individuals, they would be greater than the common good of one individual emperor over the nation of Rome. So they said, we could form a greater army to take out the nation of Parthia and bring Christianity into line with what we want to do. And so we're going to set the standards by which they're going to serve us. So we have to make sure they see how powerful we are. So what did Crassus do? He decided that he was going to subdue Parthia in 53 BC. But it didn't go exactly as planned. It didn't go how he wanted it to. In the Battle of Carrhae, 20,000 Romans were killed. 10,000 Romans were taken into captivity or captured as prisoners of war. And the worst thing that could ever happen to a conquering Roman army was that their insignia or their flag was captured. By any standard, any Roman battle commander, if they were to come back into the city without their Roman insignia, would almost immediately be put to death. So most of the time, these Roman commanders would commit suicide on the battlefield. So here's this small nation of Parthia, by a chance, did not really overthrow the Roman government, but had a huge hand in the beginning of the downfall of the Roman Empire. And so God is using this small nation as a tool to show Christianity that I'm the one that's in control. Doesn't matter how big the Roman Empire gets, I'm the one that's in control of anything, and I'm going to use whatever entity I have, no matter how big or how small, to help the nation of Rome fall. And so therefore, any Parthian imagery that we see throughout the book of Revelation, and we'll talk about this, is God using this particular government or this small country to help overthrow the nation of Rome. So here's the question I want to ask also. Why do you think Rome fell? It's believed that probably because of internal decay or the moral and virtuous values that were beginning to be put by the wayside. And so there's five specific reasons that were mentioned in the history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire that was written by Edward Gibson. The first thing that Edward Gibson says is the rapid increase of divorce, the undermining the dignity and the sanctity of the home, which is the basis for human society. And so what you began to see was the home falling apart at its nucleus or at its core. And because of that, it was beginning to affect everything else. You had Roman soldiers who were divorcing, losing their children, and because of that, it was affecting the way that they were fighting. Gibson also goes on to say in number two, higher and higher taxes and the spending of public money for free bread, free public assistance, and the circuses for the populace. So they said, we're going to make sure that we pay for everything that everybody has. So let's keep raising their taxes, right? We're going to pay for all their food and let's entertain them at the same time. Number three, the mad craze for pleasure. Well, they were bloodthirsty sports individuals. And so you would see a lot of times, right, you see some of these movies and you see these stadiums and they would bring in the lions and they would have these massive blood sport fights and all of these different things. That's what became such a big craze during this time. And so sports became more exciting and more brutal every year. They required more and more bloodthirst because that was what was exciting to them. Number four, the building of gigantic armaments when the real enemy was within because of the decadence of the people. So they tried to increase the size of their army. So they were making bigger Trojan horses. They were trying to make bigger armies and kind of spread out and take more territory. And because of that, all the time and all the while, they're falling apart from within their own selves. But number five, Gibson said the decay of religion. Faith was fading into basically just a mere form. It's the idea of religion as a whole, but they were losing touch with life and they were becoming incapable to warn and guide the people. You know what I find interesting is that Edward Gibson's book on the fall of Rome was written in 1776, the same year the United States was born. And it's interesting as you look back through some of these things, if perhaps maybe we ourselves, if we're not careful, are going to repeat the same history of the Roman Empire. And that we can fall from within. Remember, God raises up kings and brings down kings. And so these five factors we have to consider, again, being published the same year, it certainly makes one think. So when you think about all of these different types of symbolism that we've talked about, probably the historical aspect of symbolism plays the biggest key role in understanding the book of Revelation. Because when you can bring in the background of all of these things that were happening, of which John is going to write about and lace within this apocalyptic literature of which Christianity would understand. Remember, the whole premise and message is we understand the conflict between good and evil in the book of Revelation. And John says we have this conflict or this war that's raging, but we also have the apparent defeat of good from evil. And so good is going to conquer. The ultimate victory is going to be good. We win in the end. Remember, Jesus is going to conquer everything. And so the message of victory is this reoccurring theme throughout the book of Revelation. Just as he's using the nation of Parthia to overcome or to conquer the nation of Rome, he says, look, something even as small as this little bitty nation was going to help with the downfall of the Roman Empire, which was this massive and large entity as a whole. And so here you have Christianity, which is something so small and minute, is going to have a great impact on something that's so large and so big. And so when we think about it and we understand that we live in the greatest nation in the world, it doesn't mean that God is not going to use other means to bring it to its knees, to bring it into subjection to Him. And so it helps, certainly, when we think about the history lesson behind this, that no nation is greater than God Himself. No nation is more powerful, knows more, or thinks they know more than God Himself. And so John is simply trying to encourage a people to say, look, we've got to just hold on a little bit longer. God is going to come back. But the ultimate victory in the end is ours. Isn't it always, when you think about being a Christian, isn't it nice to know that we win? We don't have to wait for the outcome. We don't have to wait for the end of the movie. We don't have to wait for the end of the book. We know God promises us that victory and an eternity with Him. And so everyone tonight is afforded the same opportunity of eternity. Because we know the victory is ours, because we know that we win, you have an opportunity tonight to be part of that kingdom. And so tonight, if you choose to come forward, if you choose to put on Jesus Christ in baptism, first repenting of your sins, confessing your faith in Jesus Christ, Paul said, with the mouth confession is made unto or for the purpose of salvation, Romans 10, and finally having your sins washed away, then tonight you have an opportunity to be a part of that kingdom. And tonight, if you need encouragement or we can pray for you, if you're hurting, whatever you need tonight, we want you to know that we're here for you and we want to pray for you as together we stand and as we sing.